It's time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Barnes. Today, I want to share with you an interview that I actually did back in the spring for Cowboy Champions Summit. I know some of you took part in that summit the first week in June, and so you may have already heard this, but for those of you who haven't, this was one of the most popular interviews of the summit and one that I got the most feedback on. Many of you also purchased the archives from the summit so that you could refer back to the 6 interviews I did again and again, and those aren't available to purchase at the moment. But for those of you who missed it, hopefully this will give you a little taste of what it was all about. But before I dive into this interview, I just want to remind you guys that I'm still looking for your audio contributions to the podcast. So if you want to record a bumper for me that says, hey, I'm so-and-so, you're listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast, that would be awesome. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me what you like to do when you're listening to the podcast. I know some of you like to listen to it while you're riding or cleaning stalls. And also, I would love to hear some story contributions from you guys. I'd love to learn more about you and give me a little background about what you're all about. You can go to speakpipe.com/EYSpurs or go to earnyourspurs.com and click on the open mic link to leave me a voicemail. Currently, it only lets you leave a 90-second voicemail. So if you have a little bit longer story that you want to contribute, which I would love to share, you can email me at alyssa@earnyourspurs.com and I can let you know how you can do that. So before I jump into the interview that I'm going to share with you today, I want to share one of the most recent contributions I received from Bobby Deba.
Hey, Alyssa. My name is Bobby Deba, and I am probably one of the only Persian cowboys out there. My story starts out when I was a kid growing up in a suburb of Denver. Always had a passion for horses, never was around them, didn't grow up on a ranch, but that passion just continued to grow. I always wanted to be a cowboy. After graduating college, I was lucky enough to move to Durango, Colorado, and start working on ranches. Whoever would take me in, as green as I was, I couldn't get enough exposure to, you know, animals, horses, cows, loved it all. I was an outfitter for a few years, running strings of mules and horses up to elk camps, packing out game, bringing supplies. I recently moved to a suburb of Houston, Texas with my fiance, and we live on a little farm. Couldn't have a better lifestyle. So for all those guys out there that, you know, don't think they can do it, you know, just keep trying. Just have passion. Good luck to y'all.
Thank you so much, Bobby, for sending that in. It was great learning a little bit more about you and a super inspiring message as well. Now, today's interview is going to be with Horseman Van Hargis. You can find Van at vanhargis.com. He also has a podcast in iTunes called Ride Every Stride. So without further ado, here's Van Hargis. Hello and welcome to this session of the Cowboy Champions Summit. Allow me to introduce you to our speaker today, Mr. Van Hargis. Thank you so much for being on today, Van.
Well, Alyssa, thank you. I appreciate your time and thank you for having me. It's an absolute honor. You know, we met several years ago at the Nile out in Billings, Montana. And it's a real pleasure that you called me and asked me to be a part of this. I'm real honored by that. Thank you so much for having me.
You're so welcome. And I'm really glad that you could be here. And just to give a little bit of a background on Van, he is just a super well-rounded horseman. That's what kind of stands out to me about him. He specializes in quilt starting and ranch horse versatility, but also has roots in rodeo, western pleasure, hunter jumper, dressage. I mean, you've kind of done it all. And now you travel the country,
putting on clinics, teaching people how to better communicate with their horses. And you just launched a new podcast called Ride Every Stride, which is very exciting to me, being a podcaster myself. So I think that's really cool. So today we're going to talk about some practical advice to help simplify horsemanship by giving our audience the tools to basically solve any problem with their horses by, as you say, reducing to the ridiculous. I would love if you could just kind of give us a little bit of a brief background on your career and kind of how you got started and what brought you to where you are today before we get into the meat of the discussion.
Okay. Well, Alyssa, I guess you could say when I was growing up, I was kind of that athletic nerdy type of kid. I mean, I was always into all sorts of sports, horses included, but I was also very inquisitive. I was always wanting to learn things. And my stepfather was a part-time school teacher and actually he's a full-time school teacher for the Dallas Independent School District in Texas. And he was also a part-time horse trainer. So as a result of that, I was always exposed to a lot of horses. And, you know, not just the horses that we were raising and showing, but also horses of our clients. Also, like a lot of folks out there, I got my start in showing and competing in 4-H. Again, my parents were the 4-H leaders for our local 4-H club. So I was exposed to, you know, taking all the other neighborhood kids to all the 4-H shows and all the competitions. And in fact, I actually went to a judging contest before I was even old enough to go to the judging contest. I didn't know that at the time, since my parents were the leader of the 4-H organization. They were kind of letting me hang out. And before you know it, I had registered for a horse judging competition that I didn't know I was not allowed to be in. But I showed up anyway and did it. And that just kind of spurred my interest, I guess. The 4-H organization really spurred my interest into pursuing horsemanship at a different level. Through 4-H, I had an opportunity to meet some just phenomenal trainers who were that day and time just willing to share their knowledge and their skills with kids like me that were inquisitive enough to ask a lot of questions. So I really have to credit 4-H for kind of getting me kind of started in the horsemanship aspect of things and introducing me to some really cool horsemen along the way. There was a brief time there that I had to kind of give up my horses and make a decision how I was going to go to college. And there were a very limited number of colleges that I liked that had rodeo scholarships at that day and time. So that kind of left me looking for a scholarship in football. I wanted to go to college, but unfortunately, we just didn't have a whole heck of a lot of money. So the only way I was going to get to college, of course, was through football. And then shortly after I got out of college, I got right back into the horse industry again. And one thing led to another, and I ended up moving to New Zealand for a brief time. And I have to give credit to the New Zealanders for exposing me, I guess you could say, to my aptitude to teach and communicate. Where I was from, I thought everybody knew about horses and horsemanship. But yet when I get over there, I realize that these guys were really craving what we here in America take for granted sometimes about our horsemanship skills. And not that the Kiwis aren't great horsemen. They are. They're just phenomenal. Matter of fact, they're very competitive on the Olympic level almost annually. So I don't want to say that they're not great horsemen over there. They are. It's just that while I was there, they craved so much of the knowledge that we have here on a daily basis that it presented me the opportunity to teach horsemanship to them. And I realized at that point in time, I just had an aptitude for it. And I absolutely loved helping people understand a little bit more about horses and how to communicate with them. And when I moved back to the States, it was just like everything just escalated from there. And from the year 2000 onward, we've spent a significant amount of my time each year traveling to horse expos and to clinics, trying to help people out on a much larger level with their horsemanship.
You've learned how to really teach people along the way, in addition to training horses, which is kind of two different things. So you talk a lot about simplifying problems and sort of breaking it down in a way that people can tackle them more easily, kind of that whole, you know, how do you eat an elephant thing? So can you kind of explain your philosophy on that?
Sure. You know, horses are creatures of habit, just like we humans are. And if we understand horses for what they are, horses, they're not substitutes for a lost pet. They're not substitutes for a bad relationship. They're horses. And if we can understand that first, and we should spend our time studying horses for what they are and not for necessarily what we want them to be, again, these substitutes, but just for what they are. And then we begin to combine what they are from what we would like to mold them to be, whether or not that would be a performance horse or just a trail riding horse. In other words, whatever it is we want our horses to do for us and achieve with us, then we need to think about those steps to make that horse training process very simple. But we have to think of it simply from their perspective and not necessarily from ours. We want to focus on our goals, but we have to think about the communication skills from their perspective. You know, hence the term, and I'm not a big fan of the term, but I appreciate where it comes from and what it means. But, you know, we hear the term natural horsemanship all the time. Well, Alyssa, have you ever stopped to think what that really means? I mean, if we look at it from a literal standpoint, natural horsemanship makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, because there's nothing natural about the horse-human relationship, is there? But yet, if we look at it from the perspective of its spirit and intent, which is it's to emulate languages or a form of communication that the horse can relate to. And if we understand that horses are all about survival, and that they're great big animals with little bitty stomachs, between those two things, we have to realize that horses can be very easily trained through the conservation or the consumption of energy. We know that about horses. They would rather do the least amount possible because they're trying to conserve that energy in their system. At the same time, they want to survive, and that keen instinct of survival is what makes them so darn easy to train. But if we think about it from that perspective, that everything that we want the horse to do, we need to figure out a way to make what we want seem not only achievable, but seem easier for the horse to achieve than what they think that they want to do. I know that sounds very complex, but the reality is it's very simple. And whatever the task is that we're asking our horses to do, the simpler we can make it, then the easier it is for the horse to understand it. So the natural horsemanship aspect is just trying to communicate to them in such a way that they can relate to as we ask them to do all of these very unnatural things, such as accept a human being on their back, accept going around barrels, accept chasing cows, accept all these things that we as humans want to, pardon the term, but exploit our animals to do. We have to teach them to do that, and hopefully not do so in such an offensive manner that they just absolutely resist and refuse. So we kind of use some natural communication things to train our horses to do some very unnatural things. And even from us, from our standpoint, the things that we ask ourselves to do with our horses, we have to fight our instincts there as well. And what I mean by that is that we also have a natural instinct to conserve our souls and conserve ourselves. And as a result of that, we have certain protection mechanisms that are deeply within us, that when something goes wrong, we want to protect ourselves. But yet we put ourselves on a horse's back and potentially in harm's way. Therefore, we have to realize that in our effort to protect ourselves, we don't inadvertently miscommunicate to the horse what we want. Can I give you a little example? For example, if you just imagine a horse kind of giving us all the classic signs that he's about to come unwound and start bucking with us, our instinct is to pull in their face and to grab with our legs. That's the instinctual thing. We don't want the horse to run away with us or bolt off, so we want to pull on him to stop him from going. But at the same time, we want to hold on tight, so we reach down and grab the saddle horn and we squeeze real hard with our legs. That's the natural thing. But yet anybody that's had much experience with horses will tell you that's probably going to get you in a lot more trouble, because that's going to frighten the horse even more and cause a much more adverse effect. So even from our perspective, we have to train ourselves to do things that are kind of unnatural to us, things that instead of pulling on the horse, release him. Instead of wrapping our legs around him, widen our base so that we don't squeeze him with our feet or jab him with our spurs, and we do the opposite than what our body is and our instincts are telling us to do. So those are the first things I try to get people to realize is that let's look at our problems before they are problems and educate ourselves on what our instincts are, and then train our horses as well as train ourselves to be really good responders as opposed to really good reactors. Because the reaction thing comes natural, we want to train ourselves to be responsive as opposed to reactive. And So I guess in a way, Alyssa, that's kind of where I kind of start the whole process, is just getting people's minds thinking in a different direction, I guess you could say, and thinking about it much more from the horse's perspective than from our own perspective. And then whatever the problem may be, I don't care if it's loading a horse into a trailer or getting on his back for the very first time, what can we do to break that down into very simple steps and processes that's easy for us to communicate and easy for the horse to learn? And when we do that, it just makes the horse's progress slow but sure. And the horse, in turn, gains a tremendous amount of confidence in us being its leader. And that's what, to me, horsemanship's all about, is being good leaders to the horse.
And I think sometimes we can look at where we are and where we want to be, and it's a big leap, and we don't know the steps that come between those two points necessarily.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think sometimes it's hard for us to fathom what the steps are and how ridiculous we can actually reduce them. And to me, there's no such thing as reducing it to the point where it's really ridiculous, even though that's how I state it sometimes, reduce it to the ridiculous. And I'll give you an example. I did this, matter of fact, in Billings, Montana. I told the people there that this little filly that we were going to start under saddle there at the Nile that year, that by the end of the very first ride, I would be waving the Nile flag over the horse as if in riding her in the arena, as if I was going to be carrying the flag in the grand entry. And everybody's like, man, that's a very lofty goal. How in the heck are you going to get that done? But what I did was, is that when it came time to get the horse, not just saddled and not get me on her, but when it came time for me to actually get a flag on her back, what I did is I took a tarp, just, you know, one of those everyday run-of-the-mill blue tarps. You see them everywhere, right? But I took that thing and I folded it up to the point to where it was not much bigger than a bandana, wadded up into my hand. And when I got on the filly, I just started waving that thing around as if I was just trying to get her used to that thing. It wasn't much bigger than a brush in my hand. You know, it was just not much bigger than a bandana. And when the horse accepted that, I just rubbed her a little bit, walked her around, and then I got her to stand still again, and I unfolded it, one fold. So now it was almost twice the size that it was before, and I began to work with that. And I got her to where she was perfectly fine with that. I walked her around, let her kind of chill out for a minute, and I came back and I did it again. And before you know it, through that very slow step-by-step process, I had the band, or I had that tarp as big as I could make it and still swing it around. And I wasn't careful about it. I mean, I was like accidentally whacking her in the head with it, rubbing it over her butt and all that kind of stuff. And then I had one of the assistants there hand me the Nile flag, and I started waving the flag over her. And before you know it, I'm trotting her around in that little round pen carrying the Nile flag as if I was the rodeo queen. But that's exactly what I mean by breaking the problem down to its most ridiculous form. Rather than starting with the flag and trying to get her used to the flag, we wadded another obstacle up as small as we could possibly get it, and we let her get used to that, and we just kept getting it bigger and bigger and bigger. All the while, what do you think the horse really learned from that? She learned that no matter what I was going to present to her, I was going to present it to her in a way that was going to be developing and growing her confidence as to ever experiencing that failure. So in other words, I didn't want her to fail. I wanted her to continue to progress and gain confidence in me all along the way. So that's exactly what I mean when I'm talking about reducing it to the ridiculous. And I love to share a story, if you don't mind, Alyssa, about one of my life experiences. I went to a little bitty school called Campbell, Texas. If I would have stayed there, I'd been one of eight in my graduating class. And I guess you could say that if I would have stayed there, I would have been at least in the top 10, right? But I decided that I wanted a little bit better education, what I felt like that Campbell could provide for me. It was very small. We were very limited on the number of teachers that we had and the quality of those teachers. And I say that with all due respect. I know the school district did the best job they could, but we were very limited with our resources. And at that point in time in my life, I was really thinking about being a veterinarian. So I needed to go and get a better education to get me better prepared to get into a school that could push me toward getting into college as a pre-vet study. So I made the decision to transfer to another small town, but bigger and had a better school, but it was Commerce, Texas. Well, the thing is, I wasn't very prepared for algebra coming out of the eighth grade. I wasn't very prepared at all. And yet, in order for me to get on the course schedule that I needed, I had to have algebra as a freshman. I couldn't afford to take pre-algebra or some other sort of remedial type class. I had to have algebra. The problem was I was so far behind, I didn't know if I could pass the course. But as luck would have it, I had a teacher by the name of Ruth Ann Coffey. And Miss Coffey's way of teaching the class was to call everybody to the front of the board, one student at a time, and work an algebra problem on the board. Well, I was working at it pretty hard, and I was studying, but I was already behind in the class. And unfortunately, she called me to the front of the class one day, and she had this problem on the board, and she wanted me to work it. Just the sound of my name when she called me to the front terrorized me. I mean, I was totally afraid at that moment. But I go up there to the front, I grab the chalk, and I was stood there staring at this blackboard with this algebra problem on it, and I could feel all the students behind me just staring holes in the back of my head. Meanwhile, I could feel Miss Coffey staring at me as well. And then finally she asked, she goes, "Mr. Hargis, are you having trouble?" And I was like, "Yes, ma'am, I have no idea what I'm doing up here." And I was terrified of this. I mean, my knees were shaking. I felt like I was shaking to the point that I really thought I just might collapse. I mean, I was that worried and that afraid and that embarrassed. And then finally, Miss Coffey just leans back in her chair and she crosses her arms across her lap. And I thought she was going to be a little bit of a smart aleck because she says to me, "Mr. Van, can you add?" "Oh, yes, ma'am, I can add." "And you can subtract?" "Well, yes, ma'am, I can subtract." "You can multiply and divide?" "Well, yes, ma'am, I can multiply and divide." "Then if you can add, subtract, multiply, and divide, then you can do algebra. It's my job to teach you how and when to do those things." And Alyssa, that taught me one of the best lessons in life, is that rather than staring at the big problem and being concerned about all the things that we don't think that we can achieve and don't think that we can do, think about and focus on the things that we know that we can do. Focus on the addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. Focus on what we can get our horses to do and what our horses' skills are. And if we focus on those and enhance those, then eventually we can chip away at those bigger problems. And before you know it, that big problem just absolutely disappears. And I'm very proud to say that through Miss Ruth Ann Coffey's help, by the time I graduated, by the time I got through that freshman year, I made straight A's in algebra. And I wasn't a brain child. It was just that she made it simple for me. And most importantly, she helped me develop confidence in her as my leader and her as my teacher. But she also helped me see the skills that I had within myself and helped me gain confidence in myself to achieve these goals and to achieve these and overcome these problems. That's the lesson I want people to learn with their horses, is that whenever we run across a problem, don't be embarrassed to break that thing down to little bitty bite-sized pieces, like you said earlier. And let's eat that elephant one bite at a time, instead of focusing on this big giant elephant. And that's the way I look at everything I do with horsemanship. I try to break it down into little bitty achievable steps that before you know it, the horse learns stuff. He didn't even realize he was learning it. It just makes it that darn simple for them.
So how would you approach one of your clients, for instance, that was having problems with their horse, or maybe they're not even having a problem, but they have a goal in mind that they want to achieve. Like, I know you do a lot of versatility stuff. So how do you break those steps down for them, or help them break those steps down for themselves?
Well, it's like a lot of things, and it goes back to, again, life lessons. We want to learn to prioritize certain things. And I'll give you an example. Several years ago when ranch horse versatility was just coming about and getting really popular, it was in the early 2000s. Well, by the year 2004, I had already experienced quite a bit of success with the ranch horse versatility. And everybody was wondering, how in the heck are you doing this? Because the challenging part for me was that I was showing against older horses and I was showing young three-year-olds. And yet almost every place we went, we were winning. So before you know it, some of the magazines began to notice, how's this guy winning on all these two and three-year-old or three-year-old horses? And the answer to me was quite simple, is that we just make it easy for the horse to understand it. We focused on goals. We focused on what we wanted to achieve with our horses, and we broke those things down very, very simply. And I'll give you an example. Let's take ranch riding, for example. Out of all the ranch horse versatility things, that's probably the most fundamental thing. So we evaluated very honestly our own personal strengths and weaknesses. In other words, what is Van Hargis really good at when it comes time to go and compete? And I would really pat myself on the back about the things that I knew that I was good at, but I also would recognize my weaknesses. And then whenever I come to my training or whenever I would come to a show, what I would focus on the most would be what? My strengths. I would go and show the judges what my strengths were, and then I would survive my weaknesses. And then our horse training was the exact same thing. We would evaluate the colts, and we would determine, what is this young horse really good at doing? And we would focus on those strengths. And it's not that we would ignore the weaknesses and pray that they would go away. It's just that we would focus on the horse's strengths and then chip away little by little at the weaknesses. And then when it come time on show day, we would go and show off those strengths. And let's say on a typical judge's card that, you know, we all start with a zero. And if we all start with a zero, then every aspect of that ranch riding, which is, let's do a walk, let's do an extended walk, let's do a transition into a trot, let's do a jog trot, let's do an extended trot, let's do a canter, let's do a hand gallop. So in other words, all of those things are very simple for us to do, but we want to also evaluate what are our horse's strengths in this. And then we would accentuate those strengths and try to get pluses. In other words, we might get a plus one or a plus one and a half or maybe even just a plus half. But the last thing we would do is not accept a zero on the horse's strengths. On his strengths, we wanted to gain pluses. But however, let's say the horse was really weak in some areas. Let's say the horse didn't have just a drop-dead gorgeous stop. But stopping and backing is part of the criteria and part of the requirements for us to achieve in that particular class. Well, if he's not a real big stopper, I'm not going to go in there and try to make him stop really big on show day, because if he doesn't do it correctly, we may end up getting a zero in that area. So what I try to tell my students is, and what I try to tell the people in my clinics, is let's focus on the strengths and let's go get pluses and let's really do really good on those. And then on our weakest areas, let's just survive them. Let's settle for that zero on those. And at the end of the day, you end up with a darn good average. Well, then you multiply that times your ranch trail, your ranch cutting, and your working ranch horse. And then suddenly at the end of the day, that three-year-old colt looks pretty remarkable when you may not have won first place in every class, but you place fairly high in every class to the point to where you end up winning the average at the end of the show. And that's those bits of successes doesn't necessarily mean that you always have to win. Bits of successes means that you take what you're blessed with, you accentuate those strengths, you survive your weaknesses, and at the end of the day, you just try to have a much better than average score. So that's how that's just an example, Alyssa, is how I try to break things down for my students to the point to where we want them to focus on their personal strengths, their horse's strengths, improve on the weaknesses as we can, but most importantly, accentuate the strengths and survive those weaknesses.
Yeah, well, that's a great example. And when I was trying to show my first Snaffle Bitter, that was exactly what my dad told me. He said that, you know, my horse wasn't a big stopper, but he could lope pretty good circles. So he said, that's what you need to work on. Make your circles perfect, right, and just make your stops passable.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I have to totally agree with your dad on that one.
Yeah, I think you guys would actually agree on quite a few things. So, I mean, it's pretty simple for somebody to have a goal in mind when they're competing and they know they have to do certain things in order to score a certain way when they're at a competition. But how about for people who aren't competing and they're just maybe they have horses to enjoy and they maybe do some trail riding or whatnot, what would you suggest that they do to sort of reach their goals and maybe before we even get there, but setting goals? I mean, it's one thing to set goals when you're competing and you know it's very easy to measure from one week to the next how you're doing. But how can somebody set goals for themselves when they're not competing and, you know, how can they continue to improve?
Right. Well, you know, let's just break it down to what I call the ABCs of horsemanship, which is, you know, what I call the absolute basic criteria, ABCs. And to me, the first and foremost thing, regardless of what you're going to do with your horse, I don't care if you're going to lead it. I don't care if you're going to go on trail rides, if you're going to be a barrel racer. It doesn't really matter what we're going to do with our horse. We have to have forward movement. Now, that sounds pretty silly, doesn't it? You're going to start at forward movement? Yes, we start at forward movement. Because before I can go on a trail ride, I need this horse to move off forward. So as silly as it may sound, I ask the people, what do you want? You want a trail ride? Well, let's break that down even more. Let's get more specific. Do you want to run and bolt through the trail ride? Do you want to dodge animals along the way? I mean, in other words, let's break it down and find its most simplest form. Well, I would like to go on a nice, leisurely, quiet trail ride. So in order to achieve that, we have to master forward movement. So we start there. As silly as it may sound, I start every client and every horse off in thinking, obtaining forward movement. The next thing we want to do, Alyssa, is we want to control forward movement. And what I mean by that is there's a couple of different ways to control forward movement. We can control it directionally. We can go left. We can go right. We can go fast. We can go slow. So we have speed control as well as directional control. And again, that sounds very simple, but I'm surprised at how many people get on a horse and yell giddy up and wonder what's going on when things don't happen the way they want it to. So we really do have to stop and think about these very simple tasks and master those before we can go do more complex things. And I'm glad you mentioned the trail riding thing, because here's what gets me about the trail riding thing. In my very humble opinion, I think that too many people discount horse or discount trail riding and think that it's just a trail riding horse. Well, Alyssa, I do quite a bit of riding out on the ranch, but at the same time, I do a tremendous amount of riding in an arena. And an arena is a very controlled environment, isn't it? We have a boundary. We have nice, soft dirt. We're riding in familiar ground. And yet I strive for perfection in every stride I take, even when I'm riding in that very controlled environment on very soft ground. Everything in that environment is very predictable. It scares me to think of how many people discount the importance of good horsemanship, good safety, good control of our horses when we take them outside of that very controlled environment, that very soft dirt, and that very familiar territory. When we take our horses out on a ranch or out on a trail, we're suddenly exposed to things without boundaries, and we're exposed to things that could potentially cause a horse to do some very natural things to him, such as bolt away, find out where the other horses are. In other words, all these other potential problems that arise. And yet these problems are could be very potentially life-threatening. So we have to take even trail riding, who so many people discount as being, it's just trail riding, it's just a trail riding horse. We have to take that very seriously, because we are in a very potentially dangerous environment there. I mean, best case scenario, we might get bucked off and have to walk 5 or 10 miles, get to back to the house. But the worst case scenario is we could get bucked off and really get hurt, or we could, you know, something else could really go wrong out there in that uncontrollable environment. So to me, when I hear people say, well, we're just going on a trail ride, I want them to take that very, very seriously. Because if something goes wrong with my horse in the arena, worst case scenario, I duck, you know, pick myself off the soft dirt, dust myself off, and have to walk a few yards to go grab my horse again and start all over. But out there in the trail riding world, it could be a lot worse. It could be a lot different. So I want people to understand that those horses, we can't use those terms, oh, he's just a trail riding horse. This horse has potentially got our life in his hands. We have to really be able to trust this animal. And most importantly, this animal's really got to be able to trust us as its leader. So in that case, we want to work just as hard for on all the performance things that we work on in the performance world. We just may not have to work on them to the point of perfection like we do when we're actually competing, but we have to work on them to the point of making sure that the horse fully understands that we are a worthy leader to the horse and that we can control his nose, hips, and shoulders. We can control his attitude in such a way that when we get out of that arena setting, that we have a nice, safe mount and a nice, safe ride. So in my opinion, working on all the fundamental stuff is just as important for the horse and for the rider on our trail riding horses as it is for us performance horse trainers.
I've done a lot of different kinds of riding, but I've done mostly in the arena and competing and that kind of thing. And being up in the mountains is a whole different ball game. And all I see all around me are a million different ways to get hurt up there.
Exactly. And, you know, and not just ways for us to get hurt, but, man, a lot of ways for our horses to get hurt. I mean, one false step where you're talking about up in the mountains, you know, that could be devastating to a horse, you know. So we really have to make sure that we've got control, which is exactly why I love the title of our podcast. It's Ride Every Stride. You know, rather than waiting for a problem to get to the point where it's no longer manageable, we manage that. So every step and every stride the horse takes, not by being worried and paranoid, but by being very keenly aware. And at the very moment the horse takes one step outside of what we think is good, we need to correct it now before it escalates into something that can potentially get uncontrollable. And I'll give you an example. I do this at my clinic sometimes just to have fun. I'll be out there riding a horse around, and let's say I'm just walking, and I've got all the students in the clinic out there walking around as well, and I'm watching and observing them, and I'm watching how many things that they will allow their horses to do without correcting them. And then I might be riding a fairly young colt at one of these clinics, and let's say the colt breaks from a walk to a trot, but I didn't ask it to do it. It decided, for whatever reason, it just needed to move its feet a little bit faster, and it breaks into a trot. Well, I'll scare everybody because I'll just scream, "Oh my God, whoa, whoa, whoa." And everybody's looking at me like, "What the heck? I thought this guy's supposed to be a good horseman and he's afraid of his horse just breaking into a trot." And I just act like I'm just freaking out about it. And of course, people look at me like, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, did you see that?" "Well, yeah, it looked like the horse trotted." "Yeah, he trotted." And then I'll explain to him, "You know why I'm making such a big deal out of that? Because he trotted and I didn't ask him to. If I ignore that, then who is to say the horse can't break into a canter without me asking him to? If I ignore that, then what's to say the horse can't just bolt off and run off with me? And at what point do I realize that I am no longer in control of my horse?" And most of us wait until it escalates to the point where the horse is bucking before we ever get really worried about it. My question is, how in the heck did the horse get to the point where he's bucking in the first place? You see, so if we ride every stride and we're paying attention to them, every stride that they take, the one moment the horse is not in the direction that we want him to be or not at the speed in which we want him to be, we need to address that immediately. Not that we're micromanaging the horse, it's just that we're making those little minor corrections. And the analogy I like to use with that is that think about when you're driving down the highway. And we don't let the car run off in the ditch and crash a telephone pole before we steer it back in the middle of the road. In other words, the very moment it begins to drift that direction toward the shoulder, we don't wait until it even hits the little warning signs over to the side. As soon as we feel the vehicle drift that direction, we correct it, and we think nothing of it. We don't think that the truck's gone crazy. Look at this dadgum truck trying to hit the ditch. We don't make those thoughts about the truck and those comments about the truck. We simply just make the minor correction without even giving it much thought. It's almost what I call driving in the subconscious. And what I want people to do is I want them to learn to ride in the subconscious. It doesn't mean you're being paranoid and micromanaging your horse. You're just simply being aware of where he's going and what he's doing, how he's thinking, how he's moving, how he's breathing. You're just aware of that to the point that you're very quickly alerted when one little minor thing goes wrong, and you can correct it before it escalates into something that you can no longer correct. And the same thing goes for behaviors as well. When we notice a horse does something that we really don't think is good or safe, correct it immediately. And then before you know it, the horse will understand and, believe it or not, respect his boundaries and be quite willing to stay within those boundaries just because we keep consistently and persistently asking him to do so. And it's so much easier to manage that as opposed to waiting until problems escalate to the point where they're no longer manageable and to the point where we really do see this big, giant problem on the board. And we don't want to see that big problem on the board. We want to focus on, again, on breaking it down into little bitty, simple, manageable steps before it escalates into something beyond our control.
So is there anything that you found, you know, over the course of your career and dealing with so many different people, what tend to be the biggest challenges that people face with their horses? I mean, is there any, have you noticed any patterns?
Oh my goodness, yes. You know, and it ranges. You know, the folks have been riding for a while, but yet I would still call them somewhat novices. They have a lot of what I would call performance type issues. And what I mean by that is that one of the most common questions that I get is, you know, how do I know when my horse is in the correct lead? How do I do flying lead changes? You know, all of these things that a lot of us performance horse guys kind of take for granted. We have to realize that that's not always that easy for people to determine which lead their horse is in and how to break the lead change down into such a simple way that the horse doesn't mind doing them and it doesn't become a problem or an issue. So those are the ones that are the, for the more advanced type riders or what I would call the medium level novice type riders. But what I've also noticed, and this is kind of across the board, is a lot of the groundwork issues. I see so many women, and I'm not picking on gender here by any stretch of imagination. It's just that we have to realize that our horse industry nowadays is made up to about 85 to almost 90% women. And I see these women who are handling horses a lot of times that are really big animals. And one of the biggest issues I see is the invasion of space, the invasion of personal space. And I don't think a lot of times women, again, understand that we've got this big, giant horse standing there, and the horse may love you, but for whatever reason, it doesn't really have that respect for you. And because they're a herd animal, they want to be close to us. So we can't blame them for wanting to be close to us. But if you would, just vision with me how many times we see someone holding a horse, and the horse takes a step toward them, and the handler takes a step away. And then before you know it, the horse takes another step toward them and the handler takes another step away. Now, getting back to the issue of understanding horses for what they are, you know what that really means to a horse when you've got this big animal and he steps toward you and you move away from him? Almost on a subconscious level, that's communicating to the horse that he must be your leader because he's pushing you around. Now, I'm not saying that all horses have that intent that they want to be the leader and they're going to push you around. Not that they're trying to be bullies. It's just that they're horses and that their world of survival is all about hierarchy. Where do they stand on the ladder of hierarchy within their herd? Well, if you're the only one in the herd with them because you're standing at the end of a lead rope with them, and this horse takes one step toward you and you yield ground to that horse, he may not even realize it, but he acknowledges that he made you move. And he may not understand exactly why, because he's been domesticated for so darn long, but that one step that you yield away from him just plants a seed in his mind that he may be your leader. And then before you know it, that same person will call me and says, oh my goodness, I can't get my horse out of my space. I try to ask it to lunge around me, and instead of going around me, it comes toward me. Oh my goodness, what do I do? And they don't want to hear the answer oftentimes, because the answer is stand your ground. Get your horse to yield away from your space, claim your territory. And oftentimes that's a little bit scary when we're, you know, a 5'4 woman weighing 120 pounds trying to push around an animal that weighs 1,200 pounds. But that's the type of thing that we really have to do, is understand that we must stand our ground, put whatever pressure that we need to on that horse to make them yield back and away from us and make them respect that area. And again, I tell people, I don't care what pressure you apply, just whatever it is. And I demonstrated something at the Iowa Horse Fair not too long ago, to where I was just standing with a horse. The horse walked up very close to me. And the thing is, Alyssa, I didn't invite it to come in that close. So as I'm talking to the audience, I just began to swing my arms like I was just a kid out on the playground, just swinging my arms and having a good time. But every time I would swing my arms, I accidentally hit the horse. And before you know it, I became such an obnoxious thing to be around, the horse just simply moved a little bit out of arm's length. I'm still swinging my arms, but the horse is no longer getting hit. And it's not that I was intentionally hitting the horse. I didn't chase the horse. I was just swinging my arms, claiming my space, so to speak. In fact, I wasn't even paying attention to the horse at all. I was talking to the audience. But then I stopped and I paused and I said, did you guys happen to notice what I did? All I did was swing my arms, and the horse gladly just simply backed up out of that space so that I wouldn't be in arm's reach, or that he wouldn't be in arm's reach. And, you know, with that, the horse learned where the safe, comfortable zone for this horse to stand would be. And it was just beyond arm's length. So women oftentimes, when they're handling these horses much larger than them, they can do the same thing without having that guilt feeling that, oh my God, I'm being mean to my horse. No, you're not. You're not being mean. You're just simply claiming your space. And that's very important because your space is important to your personal safety. So those are the types of issues that we run across a lot. And I really even try to make that very simple for people to understand how important it is to look at those issues before they escalate into something potentially dangerous.
Yeah, it's kind of like having children, right? I mean, they do better when they have boundaries, and so do our horses and even our pets, you know, our dogs or whatever. They need us to be the leader.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, and all we have to do is just have the courage to step up to the plate and express to them in a way that they can understand what it is that we want. And once we do that, it's just amazing how willing horses will be when we simply just have the courage to tell them and communicate to them what it is that we want. And you know, listen, there's four questions that I try to teach all of my students. Question number one is, what do you want? What do you want your horse to do? And when we ask that question of them, we try to get them to be as specific about that answer as they possibly can. And then the second thing is what you want fair? In other words, is it within the horse's capabilities? If I'm on a colt that's only got three or four rides on him, and really what I want this horse to do is do flying lead changes. But is it fair for me to ask a colt with only a few rides to do flying lead changes? Maybe without a rider, he could do it. He could probably do it very successfully out in the pasture on his own. Therefore, it's not fair for me to ask him to do that because of question number three. Can I communicate what I want to him in a way that he can understand? And if I can, then fine, proceed. But if I can't, then I've got to figure out a way to be a better communicator to my horse so that he understands specifically what it is that I want from him. And then lastly, how do we measure that? Did the horse do what we wanted? Did he make an attempt at doing what we wanted? Was he successful at it? Could I make any improvements? So in other words, I ask myself that question in a way to make improvements later down the road. So those four questions very quickly again are, what do I want? Very specifically, what do I want from my horse? What do I want my horse to do? Is what I want fair to the horse today? In other words, is it within his capabilities to perform whatever it is that I want today? Number three falls back on me again. Can I communicate what it is that I want in a way that the horse can understand? And then lastly, how'd we do? Did we communicate it in a way that he could understand? Did he achieve it? Could I get better at the communication? Could the horse get better at his performance? So those four things there oftentimes helps a lot of the students understand how to achieve what it is that we're trying to achieve with our horses.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm sure that's really helpful for people to be able to break it down in that way.
Right. You know, getting to that, but at the same time, getting back a little bit to what we were talking about earlier about protecting our personal space. Several years ago, I had an opportunity to help out with a legendary horse trainer / clinician. And he said to me something that it seemed very profound at the time. He said to me, he said, Van, you know, the horse is always right. And when he said that to me, I thought to myself, you know, you've obviously not ridden some of the horses I've been riding. I mean, some of the horses I'm riding, it would be very hard for me to believe that they're right. But he says, no, he says, the horse is always right because the horse is either doing what comes natural for him or the horse is doing what he thinks we want him to do. So either way, the horse is right. If what the horse is doing naturally is not what we want, then we have to be able to communicate to him what we do want. If the horse is doing what he thinks we want and that's not what we want, then we have to, again, think of a better way to communicate. So either way, the horse is always right, and the challenge is always up to us to, number one, determine what it is that we want, and number two, determine how to communicate that to him in a way that he understands. And that same trainer / clinician earlier that day was trying to get a horse to respect space. And the lady that owned the horse gladly handed the horse over to him and said, you know, this horse is really in your face all the time. It's really crowding you. You know, what would you do to this horse? And he just basically held the horse off a little bit and started whacking it with a lead rope. And at first, everybody just gasped, oh, my God, I can't believe this guy is hitting this horse with a lead rope. And the lady that owned it was just in tears after just a few minutes. And then finally, he said, lady, you know why I'm hitting your horse? And no, I don't know why you're hitting my horse. And she was pretty shook up. He said, because I can. And all of a sudden, everybody kind of stopped and paused again, thinking, man, that was kind of callous of him. That's a kind of a callous response. And he said, I can because all the horse has got to do is just move away. See, so all he was doing was just swinging the lead rope, and all the horse had to do was just back away. Now, some might think that was a bit abusive, but I don't think it was that way at all. I would think it'd be abusive if he chased the darn thing and kept whacking it with a lead rope, or I think it'd be wrong of him if he had the horse tied up and was whacking it with a lead rope. But instead, he was standing there on a fairly loose rein, and he was just tapping the horse on the shoulder with the lead rope and just kept tapping. And finally, he asked the question, lady, you know why I'm hitting him? I'm hitting him because I can. All he's got to do is move. And it kind of is that same thing I was talking about a while ago, but me swinging my arms. I wasn't chasing the horse and whacking him with my arms. I was just merely swinging my arms, and all the horse had to do was move away. So sometimes I want people to think about sometimes training is nothing more than just understanding what we want and then having the courage to communicate that to the horse. And over time, the horses are gladly going to hand over that leadership role to us. It's just that we have to have the courage to stand up and accept that leadership role.
Yeah, and that kind of goes along with my next question, which is, how would you recommend that if somebody's having an issue with their horse and, you know, maybe they don't have anyone to sort of help walk them through it at that particular time, how can you kind of start to think like a horse in order to work through problems?
You know, that's a great question, actually, Alyssa. And, you know, one of the things I really encourage people to do, if you have the number of horses on your own property, just go out and watch them in their own dynamics. Just watch what horses do with each other. And if you don't, then go someplace where somebody does have horses turned out, preferably, you know, in the pasture and a fairly good sized turnout, and just watch their dynamics. And it's amazing how quiet and how peaceful horses can be when everything's going smoothly. But yet you let one horse kind of get outside the boundaries. And it's amazing how quickly, especially the alpha horse, will correct that one horse. And sometimes it's not very easy to watch. Sometimes it can be pretty harsh. So oftentimes, though, I think if we watch those, and it doesn't mean that the horse that's being the leader is mean. It just means that it's establishing itself as the leader, and it's doing whatever is necessary to get that other horse to respond. And why is it that you think that is so important? And it's important because, number one, it keeps organization within the herd. And that organization within the herd is very paramount to the survival of each individual, but also to the survival of the herd. So what we have to realize is that whenever we go off in the pasture and we catch a horse, and we're just going to go on a nice leisurely trail ride, what we have to realize is that the minute we attach ourselves to that horse, the minute actually before we physically attach ourselves to it by putting a halter on it, leading it away, the minute we walk into that dynamic, we have to be willing to step up to the plate and be the leader of that herd. Because if we're not, then we're basically putting ourselves at a position to where these horses can dominate us. And not that horses are doing so to be malice or anything like that. They're just doing what comes natural for them. And that's the looking out for their own best interest and for the best interest of the herd. And if we don't establish ourselves as the leader, then obviously we're either a follower or we're an outsider. So we have to be able to step in there and be the leader. So the first thing I would tell people is go watch, go observe, watch what other horses do. And one thing you'll never see horses do, you don't see them attack another horse without all these warning signs that are coming first. You know, in my training program, I teach my students to squeeze, bump, kick, and kill. And that sounds kind of harsh. But what I'm looking for is I'm looking for the horse to respond to the lightest cue that I can possibly give it. And oftentimes, as weird as it may sound to some people, it's me first just thinking of what it is that I want. Because I know if I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it very specifically, before I can even begin to physically move or verbalize anything, my body is already sending signals to that horse, you know, almost in an undeliberate manner. But if, so for example, I'm riding a horse and I want to go left, the first thing I'm going to think of, I want to go left. And before you know it, my body begins to follow that. I look left. That's the second thing I do. The third thing I might do is I might turn my shoulders and look that direction and actually use my outside leg to kind of push the horse that direction. The last thing I'm going to do is pick up my reins. So after a while, the horse begins to realize that they can respond in the lightest manner possible with me just doing nothing more than just kind of thinking left and then turning my shoulders to the left. Before you know it, the horse goes left. Now let's go back to the horse scenario in the pasture. The same thing happens there. A mare might see another horse kind of invading her space, so to speak. And she might not do anything more in the beginning than just move an ear. Just look at that other horse. And if that doesn't work, she might kind of threaten the horse, kind of pin her ears and kind of threaten a little bit. If that doesn't work, she might reach over and actually try to bite the other horse. And if that doesn't work, she might wheel around and try to kick the living snot out of the other horse. So basically, they do these things in very systematic ways of progression, steps of progression. And that's a great lesson for us as horsemen to learn, too. And if we combine that with those four questions that we were talking about earlier, in other words, what do we want? Is what we want fair? Can we communicate it in a way that the horse can understand? And then how do we measure that? But when we get to the point where we need to communicate it, if we can communicate it in very slow, progressive steps that the horse can relate to, then suddenly we get horses that are much more responsive and much more sensitive to what it is that we're asking for, because in doing that the way in a very progressive manner, the horses begin to respect us as their herd leader. And that, to me, is what the leadership role is all about. You don't have to be harsh, not to be mean. You just have to be persistent and consistent with what we do. And as a result, the horse will learn to respect that. And in doing so, we not only become better and stronger leaders ourselves, but the horses respect us for that. And that's, in my opinion, just paramount in the horse-human relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting what you were saying about watching a horse in their, you know, somewhat natural environment out in a pasture or whatever. I always like to say that some people like to say that horses are unpredictable, and I don't agree with that. I think that horses are extremely predictable if you understand their behavior.
Oh, absolutely. I'm totally with you there, friend, girlfriend. I mean, I'm with you. I totally agree with that. I think horses are very predictable. They, you know, one of the things I just mentioned this in one of our clinics not so long ago. It really bugs me when I hear people say that, man, I was just riding my horse along and all of a sudden, for no reason, X happens. And I'm thinking, no, I mean, I was listening to you until you said all of a sudden for no reason. And at that point, I kind of put my fingers in my ears. Because, like you said, horses are very predictable. They give us all sorts of signs and signals of what they're doing and what they're about to do if we are just aware enough to listen to them and pay attention to them. And when I say aware, it doesn't mean we have to be paranoid and scared and again, micromanage them. It just means that we need to be keenly aware and understand that those signals could possibly mean something to us. And over time, as horsemen, you begin to learn what signals to really respond to and listen to and focus on, and which ones to maybe you can discount just a little bit and maybe even potentially ignore. But I think in the beginning, I think it's very important for us to watch those things and like you said, begin to recognize the predictability instead of the unpredictability of horses.
Is there anything else that you would like to add before we start to wrap up here?
Oh, I guess I want to reiterate by sharing just one more story, if you will, and it's about my grandparents again. One of the very first things that I ever learned to read ended up being one of the greatest lessons of horsemanship that I've learned, and I still practice to this day. And it gets back to the entire topic of what we've been talking about today. And my grandmother's sister gave her a hand-stitched piece of folk art many years ago. And it very simply says, yard by yard, life is hard. Inch by inch, life's a cinch. And it was the very first thing I ever learned to read, because it just happened to be sitting at on the wall, or actually on the wall in front of where all the kids' tables were. You know, and I don't know how you guys up there in Montana, but in the South, I mean, we all get together on Sunday afternoon, and we have some sort of family meal, and it's usually fried chicken. And the men sit at one table, and the women sit at the table with them, but the closest to the kitchen. And the kids all kind of sit in a kitchen around a table, and we all kind of have our own assigned seat, so to speak. Well, my seat just happened to be looking right up at the wall to where this hand-stitched piece of folk art was that said, "Yard by yard, life is hard. Inch by inch, life's a cinch." But I couldn't read at first, so I would just ask my mom or my aunt or my grandma, "Hey, what's that say?" And they would always read it to me. So long before I could ever actually read the words, I knew what the darn thing said. And then years later, I could actually read it myself. And what I didn't realize, Alyssa, that had planted seeds in my mind so deeply that they truly began to come back to me later as a man and later as a horseman, that were very helpful for me, because they were those. It basically taught me there are no shortcuts. To be successful in horsemanship and to be successful in humanship, there are no shortcuts. If we do try to take those shortcuts and take bigger steps in what we're capable of doing, then sooner or later, things are going to get difficult for us. Things are going to get hard for us. I think about that all the time when I watch people start colts under saddle, and they skip a step here and they skip a step there, and then they wonder why, maybe even a year later, these holes that are left in that foundation of those horsemanship, or in that horse's start, come back to haunt us. But yet when we go inch by inch and we cover every step and every step that we know how to, and we cover it as thoroughly as we possibly can, and we fill in those holes, it may seem as if we're moving slower, but we end up instead reaching our destination much quicker, much faster, and most importantly, much, much safer. And, you know, there was a great calf roper back in the day named Ernie Taylor. And Ernie taught me another good lesson that goes right along with that same thing. He said, "Van, slow down to be fast." And I kept thinking to myself as I was a kid, thinking, how would a calf roping champion, world champion, say the words, "slow down to be fast," when he's in probably one of the fastest timed events there is in the sport of rodeo? But yet what he was saying is, when you slow down, you make fewer mistakes. It takes time to go back and fix mistakes. Yard by yard, life is hard. Inch by inch, life's a cinch. And I want people to hopefully grasp that lesson like I did ever since I was a young kid, because I think it's probably one of the most valuable lessons I've learned in my life.
That's awesome, and a great way to kind of wrap things up here. Thank you so much for being here today and sharing all of that wisdom with us. And how can people find more about Van Hargis online? What's the best way to reach out to you?
Well, the best way, of course, is just via our website. We have a website that's vanhargis.com. And if they want to speak with us personally, they can just click on info@vanhargis.com, drop us an email, and we'll get back to them just as quickly as possible. And I always welcome questions. You know, you mentioned earlier that we have a podcast now, and the podcast is called Ride Every Stride. And the whole purpose of that podcast is so that we can help people understand how to get along with their horses better, how they can enjoy their horses better. If they're competitors, we want to try to help them be better competitors. Everything about Ride Every Stride is about communication with horses and making that process simpler and easier. So we really encourage people to go to vanhargis.com, send us an email, and let us know what you would like for us to address and talk about on that podcast on Ride Every Stride.
Awesome. And also, we'll have the Cowboy Champion Summit Facebook group is set up now. So anybody who wants to go in there and maybe post a question, Van, along with some of the other speakers, will be stopping in from time to time to answer questions in there as well. So it's another good way to reach him and several of the other speakers that are part of the summit.
Alyssa, I sure appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much for being a part of your program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again for being here today, Van. And I guess we'll wrap up with that.
hope you enjoyed that interview with Van Hargis. One of the things I really like about Van is that he is a great storyteller, and that is just such a valuable quality to have in order to really teach your students in a different way. I'm a firm believer that everybody has a story to share, and if you happen to have a story to share that relates to cowboy culture in any way, I would love for you to share it with me. So feel free to leave me a voicemail at speakpipe.com/EYSpurs. Click on the open mic graphic at earnyourspurs.com and leave me a voicemail there. And if you'd like to leave me a little longer contribution than the 90 seconds that it currently lets you leave, send me an email at alyssa@earnyourspurs.com, and I'll let you know how you can do that as well. So once again, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I am always, always looking for great stories. So if you have any recommendations for guests that I should have on the show, please also send me an email about that as well, or hit me up on Facebook or Twitter. I love, 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 love hearing from you guys. Thank you for making what I do worthwhile. I appreciate you listening in, and I will see you on the next episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.